Heavenly King, Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, present everywhere and filling all things, the treasury of good and giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls, gracious one. Okay. Right, welcome again. This evening, I'd like to welcome as the first of our CYC speakers for the year, Mr. George Halkias, or Halkias, depending on which way you pronounce his surname. I know it's English, it's Halkias, but in Greek, it's Halkias. That's correct, isn't it? Yeah. Now, I haven't told you this before, George, but I first saw George Halkias on the front page of the White Pages, as some of you may have, some years ago now. And I just happened to see the photo and what was happening there, and I saw a Greek name. And I don't know why I thought this, but at the time that I saw that photo, something, I didn't know George at all, didn't know where he was, any connections, anything, and something told me at that moment that one day I'm going to meet this man. I don't know why I thought that, but I just had this feeling that one day I was going to meet this man. Well, can you imagine how surprised I was when the first time I met him was actually because one of our epitropi, one of our committee members here at our parish, happens to be not only his uncle, but his godfather. So during some sort of family connections that way is when we first met. And it was actually at a funeral that we started talking, and I realized, hey, this is the guy I saw on the White Pages. And we got talking away, and since then we've spoken many times, and I'm very, very grateful from the moment that George offered to give such a talk as tonight. Because one of the things that I thought would be very helpful for all of us is to hear from somebody who lives in such a way where he's trying to, obviously not on his own, with groups of other people, to do something for the people who are living on the streets of Melbourne and across Australia. And people who are living in a difficult type of life. Now, I know George will give quite a bit of the details of what got him to where he is now and what he's done over his life. But I'm looking forward particularly to hearing, because most of us see people in strife and we sometimes wonder, how can we help? What can we do when we see people living in such difficult times? I remember some time ago I heard an interview on the radio, and it was a young man who was once upon a time living on the streets of Melbourne, and he since then got his life together and was able to move away from that lifestyle and got a job and was settling down, was about to get married, and you know, things were going well for him in his life for the first time in many years. And the interviewer on the radio actually asked him, he said, look, on those days that you're actually living on the streets, what would you have liked someone walking past to do or to say? What would have been important for you then? And the interviewer, I think, was expecting him to say, oh, to give him $5 or $20 or something. And he thought for a moment, he says, you know what would have really been very good? If someone just walked past and said good morning to me. And the interviewer was baffled by that. He was quite shocked. It was the last thing I think he expected. Because what this young man was saying is that my dignity had been virtually destroyed. And just someone saying hello to me would have been what I really needed back then. Yes, when people helped me out financially, that was great. But to actually have someone say hello was what I really needed then. And I know part of the work that George does is particularly to work towards helping people regain their dignity and feel a sense of worth after feeling so much unworth, if that's the right word. So, George, welcome very much to this evening, and we all look forward to anything you may wish to share with us about yourself, your life, and your work. Thank you.
It's actually quite a unique setting to be actually doing a presentation. I've done thousands in my life, but none in a church like this. Let me get my bearings. But I trust everybody's had a good Monday, and hopefully I can provide you this evening with a bit of stimulation and something to think about. I guess I'm going to share with you an amazing personal and professional journey, one that's not only changed my life forever, but I like to think has changed the life of many vulnerable Australians forever as well. And I guess I want to do that in the context of my own personal life, and you can have a better understanding of how I got to where I am and some of the things that motivate me and influence, I guess, the way I see the world. So perhaps I can start by giving you some brief personal background about myself. Obviously, I'm of Greek background and my parents migrated to Australia back in the late 1960s from down south, Peloponnesus, two very primitive villages in Lakonia and Arkadia. And I guess my parents, like many migrants back in those days, came to Australia to seek opportunity and to seek a better life. And that they found, and I have to be very appreciative of the opportunities that they've given me over the years. A great education, a lot of love, a lot of support, and great role models. Both my parents were amazing to me, or have been, and continue to be amazing to me. My mother's an amazing pillar of strength. She's a pint-sized woman, but she packs a mean punch, and when things are, you know, pretty down and out, she's the one that's really going strong. My dad also is a quiet, gentle man. He's president of the Aya Katerini Church, so he too is a man of religion and a man of principle, and one that I admire. So I really appreciate, I guess, the foundation that my parents have given me as a young person. And as a young person, I was, I guess, you know, a good student, a relatively good student, but I had probably another love and another interest, and that was sport. So I used to, like many Australians do, or many young people do, eat, breathe and sleep it. So, you know, my parents would try and harass me to do my homework, and I'd be out there kicking a footy or a soccer ball. I'm sure many of you can relate. And many a sporting team or club would knock on our door and say, look, we'd like your son to play footy for our club, or we'd like him to play cricket. And Dad would say, Greek school takes precedence, and that would really frustrate me, let me tell you. But, you know, and at the same time, I guess as a young person, I was always, I guess, clashing with my identity a bit. You know, in a middle-class suburb or upper-class suburb of Glen Iris, where I grew up, I did get a very good education, but I often, you know, wondered about my identity because, you know, there was a segregation between the Anglos and the Greeks, and the Wogs played soccer and the Aussies played footy, and sometimes I really wanted to fit in. Thing is, I liked footy too. I liked soccer, I liked cricket, I liked everything. And in some ways, I harboured this dream to represent my country. I always had that dream and probably thought it was never going to happen. And as you'll hear, it happened in probably the most unique and obscure way, but I did end up representing my country. But I went to Melbourne High School, and I'm happy to say I've seen an old school colleague here tonight that I haven't seen for many years. Alex, where are you? Good man. And so a bit of reminiscing to occur later. So I went to Melbourne High School, a very good school, and ended up somehow at Melbourne University studying a science degree. And I guess these days kids probably get a little bit more career education and career advice than what we did back then. So I end up doing a science degree and, you know, working in a lab and blowing up all sorts of things in inorganic and organic chemistry, which pretty much wasn't the type of person that I was or wasn't going to be my passion. But somehow I discovered the discipline of psychology, the study of human behaviour and human thinking. And I guess it's that time that I probably thought this is an area that I'd like to work in, an area that I'd like to contribute in, and maybe, you know, use, I guess some of the values of compassion and, you know, helping people in a way that, you know, sort of relates to the person I am. So completed an undergraduate psychology degree, a postgraduate degree. And my first job was probably the best apprenticeship I could ever possibly have, and that's working in a public housing estate in Collingwood. So this is where I get to see homelessness in its true sense, where we were going to provide support and housing to people experiencing homelessness. So all of a sudden, the boy from Glen Iris, who's had everything and pretty much a self-confessed mummy's boy, is about to be exposed, I guess, to some of the harsh realities of life, and that being homelessness. And homelessness, I guess, is something that you see differently depending on where you are, what you read, what you see on TV. And like many of you, I guess the only view of homelessness I had was of people sleeping on the street, people sleeping on street benches, people sleeping in the parks, that sort of thing. And maybe even, you know, old men, hobos, all that sort of thing, which, you know, is how often media portray it and how others portray it. But I get to see it in a different light. And homelessness being a lot more than that, and the demographics of homelessness being a lot wider than that. And It's estimated in today's society that we have 120,000 people each night, like tonight, that 120,000 Australians that are homeless. Now, probably a tenth to a 15th of those will be people sleeping on the street, many of, as I described a little bit earlier. But there's another proportion too who are in unsafe, unsecure, short-term crisis accommodation. Now, they mightn't have a roof over their head, but they themselves are deemed homelessness because they're living in a pretty insecure, vulnerable situation. And you have to look at some of the reasons and some of the, I guess, factors that contribute to one's homelessness, and they're so varied but so significant, from mental illness to substance abuse, domestic violence, child abuse, long-term unemployment, poverty, all those that can render somebody homeless. And so, as I mentioned, you know, a boy who's got it all in Glen Iris and gets looked after by mum is somehow exposed to people of all ages, of both genders, in different situations who are homeless. And it's confronting. It's confronting. You sit there, and yes, you demonstrate empathy, but it does hit the bone and gives you probably, and what was for me at that first time, the first sense of perspective that I've ever received. And so providing them housing, providing them support, was something that I found rewarding, I found it challenging, but it's something that started to make me the person that I am and motivate me to do more in that sort of area. So that was a good initiation and a good apprenticeship, 2 years there. And from there I moved to a government department, the Department of Justice, where I managed a service for victims of crime. So from the heat back into the frying pan. But this was an amazing statewide service that provide a range of counselling services and practical services and information to victims of all crimes, violent crime, emotional abuse, sexual abuse, you name it. It was a one-stop shop that we were really proud of. It was a call centre manned or personed by social workers and psychologists where people could call and find out about their rights and entitlements, be treated with dignity and respect, get the information that they need, and also get all the important services and supports that they need. And that might be counselling, or that might be support groups, or that might be just somebody to be there with them in court. So I did that for 8 years and found that, again, enormously rewarding and challenging. And again, probably opened my eyes, I guess, to, you know, something that really hurt, in that so many people were actually somehow violated or abused by people that they'd known. So again, something that shaped me and something that gave me a lot of compassion for people who were vulnerable and experiencing trauma and experiencing pain. So another 7-odd years at Department of Justice, my next step was in the community sector, and I moved to an organisation called The Big Issue in Australia. I hope that many of you are familiar with that organisation. It's an organisation that has an amazing history, which since 1996 has been helping homeless and vulnerable people in a different way by providing them a form of employment. And The Big Issue is probably best known as a magazine. It's a magazine that the community organisation produces on a fortnightly basis, and it is sold by homeless people, people with disabilities, people with mental illness, people with a range of social issues on the streets to help them get their feet back on track and earn a little bit of extra money and build their self-esteem and self-confidence. And it's an amazing example of a social enterprise. Quite simply, these people buy the magazine for $2.50 from our organisation and they sell it for $5 and make a profit of $2.50. But for me, they're probably the most courageous Australians you'll ever find. To actually wear a vest, you know, that emblazes the Big Issue emblem, and to tell the world that you're homeless, or to tell the world that you know, you're suffering these personal issues, yet to be out there on the street, rain, hail or shine, sometimes be looked upon, sometimes being discriminated, often ignored, yet you're doing that to change your life, to earn a few extra bucks, and to turn things around, to me, demonstrates an enormous amount of courage, an enormous amount of dedication. And quite often, you know, we hear about people in those situations being called bludgers or being called useless, and yet these people are showing more motivation than you can imagine. For some of them to get out of bed and to do that and to overcome, you know, their inner fears is, to me, one of the greatest things that one can ever do, and to me they're true heroes. So I came to that organisation in 2004 and to manage a program to take the magazine to regional areas, because you see, most people think that homelessness, pardon me, only exists in capital cities because you see it in the city and you see people sleeping on the streets, and you don't see that in the country, but in fact you do. Not only do you see people on the streets in country towns, but you also see as I mentioned earlier, people who might have a roof over their head but vulnerable of losing that housing at any time. So I came to manage a program to take that to regional Victoria. And I guess that's when this unique personal journey took place, when I think it was probably on that first day that I got to the office, we received an email from an organisation called the Homeless World Cup for our organisation to run a street soccer program and to attend the 2005 Homeless World Cup of Edinburgh that year. Now, when most people hear about Homeless World Cup, they'll scratch their head the way I did and think long and hard about what it could mean and what it could actually look like. And so you have to do a bit of research. You draw some breath and you think, even though I love my sport and it sounds like a good idea, is it really what it is? And so the research shows to me that what happened was the Big Issue organisation belongs to a whole network of similar organisations, street papers around the world helping homeless people in this way. And they get together annually to talk about ways to sell more magazines and to help homeless people through the sale of the magazine. And at one of their annual conferences, one of the concerns they had was that they didn't have any of the vendors, the people selling the magazine, the people that they worked with at the conference, contributing and giving feedback and giving them, I guess, their own perspective. And they also talked about the possibility of doing that, but one of the concerns they had also was they didn't speak a language, a universal language. Where two bright sparks, one from Scotland and the other one from Belgium, thought probably the one language that they all did speak was that of football or soccer. So something that probably started off in the bar in this conference became something amazing. And what happened was each of these programs started to use sport or soccer as a vehicle to help homeless and marginalised people. Because you think about it, what are the positives that sport gives you? It gives you a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging. It improves your fitness, your self-esteem, gets you in a team environment, gives you a routine. We could probably all relate to that. And what are most people in that situation, the homeless people, missing? All of those things. So each of these organisations and street papers around the world started running what we call street soccer programs, working with the people that were selling the magazines and others, and trying to use sport as a vehicle to change their lives. But added to that, they decided to come together once a year and run an event called the Homeless World Cup where they could represent their country. Pretty far-fetched, pretty amazing. So my research was pretty sound, and I liked the idea of it because I love my sport, I love my soccer, and I loved helping people. So I got onto the task of starting a street soccer program in Melbourne, and that took place in Fitzroy in Atherton Gardens. It's a public housing estate. And so myself and a few other colleagues and volunteers started a program in the high-rise where we encouraged our vendors, people in rehabs, people in shelters, in crisis accommodation to come and enjoy the value of sport. Now, I have to admit the first day was inauspicious to say the least. We had to convince a couple of players, a couple of our vendors to come and participate. We had to bribe them with a couple of magazines. And it was all looking pretty grim, to be honest. I just thought, well, we got more volunteers than players here. Do homeless people have bigger fish to fry? They've got to find accommodation. They've got to get Centrelink. They've got counselling. They've got other important things to worry about in their life. But somehow I stood firm. And as we left and we're packing up the balls, this tall gentleman, barefooted, wearing shorts, comes up, sees the soccer ball, just runs barefooted through the grounds of the Atherton Gardens, which in a public housing estate is probably not the wisest thing to do. But he kicks the ball, I guess in anger, and he turns around, smiles and says, "What are we doing? Let's play." And so we started talking, and turns out that he lived in one of the crisis centres just across the road. And he said, "Oh, I've been waiting to play a bit of sport. I haven't played sport for years. I haven't got many friends. I'd love to be involved." His name was Yusuf. And that gave me a bit of hope. He said, "I'll be back next week with a few of my friends from the shelter." And so next week came, and we had 6 players. Then we had 8 players, and it started to grow. And what started to grow was something special, because Yusuf and his friends were starting to really enjoy the football, the camaraderie. They were enjoying my support. Little did they know I was a psychologist dressed up as a soccer coach. But they had a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging. We'd get together every week. Anecdotally, they'd tell me the night before they wouldn't take drugs or drink so they could feel good on the day. And that day, if I'd worked them into the ground, they'd sleep pretty well, so couldn't get into trouble. So there was 2 days out of the seven covered. But it was a great way for us to connect together and for me to give them information about services and ways that I could support them. So we started to do things outside of soccer as well. So social events, we'd go to the football together or go to the movies together. And all of a sudden we had our own little community, our own little family, our own street soccer family that could support each other, look after each other, which was something special, and we'd grown that ourselves in a short period of time. But I guess we had an even bigger project on the side, and that was to send a team to that first Homeless World Cup of 2005. And that was going to be a logistical nightmare. As you might imagine, sending a team of homeless people to an international event to the other side of the world is not going to be an easy task. Think of the funding, the logistics, the practicalities. Think of all the things you might need to coordinate to do that. And I must admit, with a couple of months to go, it all looked pretty grim. We'd knocked on so many corporate doors, government doors, philanthropic doors, and nobody really wanted to take the punt. They really couldn't understand it. They thought it was too risky. They weren't quite sure what this Homeless World Cup was about. They really didn't want to, you know, take a chance of being associated with it in case it went haywire. So we were very lucky, with probably 2 months to spare, we happened to be on an ABC state line show. And the then president, and I have to give him a plug, of the Essendon Footy Club, a guy by the name of, God, I can't believe he's escaped me because I owe him so much. It'll come to me. That's tragic, isn't it? Maybe it was the environment. But this gentleman essentially sent us $15,000 check on the Monday, no questions asked, and wished us good luck. So our white knight arrived. Ray Horsburgh was his name. I couldn't believe I forgot that. Is he here by any chance? No. So Ray Horsburgh, chairman of the Essendon Footy Club, a different code altogether, who works for a big mining company. Instead of us putting all the submissions, going and knocking on doors and just killing ourselves senselessly trying to get that money, he sent it to us on Monday, no questions asked. And so I guess our journey to Edinburgh began. And so we had a few other challenges to think of: organising passports, organising visas, preparing our players, selecting players. So we had a handful of players. Well, we probably had a dozen, and we had to, pardon me, size it down to eight, because we take eight players each team. And so how do we select a team? Do we do it on skill level? Do we try and win this Homeless World Cup? Do we do it on attitude and commitment and passion? Because that's, I guess, what it was about. This was a program to change lives. It wasn't to produce the next Mark Viduka's and Harry Kewell's. And so what we did probably shocked a few people, but we chose some players who couldn't kick a ball, a couple of girls who couldn't kick a ball. And I guess that's when the culture of the program was first developed, that this program was about changing people's lives. It was about using the program to overcome those challenges. So we chose eight players, and you can imagine the excitement in their faces when we first told them. So we organised passports and visas. It wasn't going to be easy. I can recall one of our players with a few weeks to go says to me, "George, I've got to talk to you about something. Does it matter if you have an outstanding warrant? Can I still travel?" I said, "That might be a problem." But we sat down together, and he had to go back to fly to Queensland. So he was working at the time. He was washing some dishes in St Kilda. And he got the money to go up to Queensland and face this outstanding warrant. And he got a suspended sentence, and he was able to travel. But that, to me, started to demonstrate the motivational change that could take into the players. So we got uniforms through Nike. We organised our passports and visas. We had to organise the players' medication. A few were on methadone, so we had to make sure we could take that overseas or get that over there. And it was all looking okay. Remember, I'm still managing the other projects, so this was sort of done on a voluntary basis, and I'm looking a pretty sort of sore and sorry sort of soul at that time. But it was in 2005, with 4 days to go. You might recall that the London bombings took place on the Wednesday. We're leaving on Saturday, and I get a call from the UK High Commission that says, "George, we've got a bit of a problem. You're going to Edinburgh, and the UK High Commission says they're going to be really stringent on visas and passports and people entering their country. I said, what does that mean? They said, all your players must fill out extra visas and be assessed whether they can come into the country. The question for me was, okay, we can do that. We've got 3 days to go. It's going to be tough, but we'll give it a go. What about myself? You don't have to do it. Which sort of says a little bit about where they were coming from and makes an interesting point. But so we got closer to the mark, closer to the day of leaving, and we've got 7 passports and visas. We're missing one. We're missing our friend Yusuf, the man that I mentioned earlier. He himself has been doing some factory work. I haven't been able to get him. He doesn't carry a mobile phone. He's got his heart set on leaving for Edinburgh on the Saturday, and we're doing everything possible to find him. We've got all our networks, all the homeless networks, all the vendors on the street looking for him. We have to fly these visa applications to Canberra the next day, and then somebody's got to bring them back on the Saturday for us to fly. By 11 o'clock on Thursday night, I've given up hope. Given up hope. And again, thanking God, somebody runs into Yusuf at night at 11:30, takes him, a friend of ours, takes him to the pharmacy to get his visa passport photo and completes all the forms for him and brings them to me the next day to be sent to Canberra. So we have a team set to go, dressed in the green and gold, ready to represent their country in Edinburgh. Pretty weird, isn't it? We get there and experience something unbelievable. There are 27 countries from around the world who run similar programs, who have participants and players who are experiencing the same issues, yet different issues. And they come together to play in this amazing sporting tournament in front of thousands of people. And all of a sudden, people are seeing homeless people as sporting heroes. Something totally different. Whereas they used to discriminate against them, used to look at them differently, they're now seeing them as sporting heroes and people that want to change their lives. And I guess that was the power of the Homeless World Cup, to be able to change stereotypes, to be able to change people's views. And the Homeless World Cup's an amazing event. The players come together as one. They share information, they share experiences. They talk to each other about some of the personal problems that happen in their lives and the passion of how they want to change them. And that year we actually won a few games. And I recall towards the end of the competition, we're playing Scotland, the home nation, Friday afternoon, quarter final. And it's all our Australian team preparing to play Scotland. Our guys are very nervous. We didn't come here to win. We came here to have fun, and they were having fun. But all of a sudden, there was a pressure. But the two girls hadn't had much of a run. They were a bit nervous playing in front of big crowds. And two of the players came up to me and said, George, the purpose of this was for us to get something out of it and to work as a team. And I think the girls have to start the game. They haven't made the contribution. We haven't really supported them. We've got to turn things around. Let them start the match. And it was a fantastic game, end to end. We play street soccer, which is a four-a-side format, on a tennis court, and it's got boards. There were thousands of people. They were cheering for Australia. They were cheering for Scotland. And Scotland win with the last kick of the day. Their captain scored the goal. But our girls had the time of their lives, and we lost the quarterfinal. And the players came together as one, celebrated the Scottish victory. They were relieved. And again, the culture of the program, I guess, was developed further. So an amazing event. For me, a tear or two was shed when they sang the national anthem. I was wearing the tracksuit, the Nike tracksuit, the Aussie tracksuit, and I thought, how the hell did I get here? But an amazing experience, the Homeless World Cup. And most of those guys, to be honest, found it a little bit difficult, which made my life very difficult, let me tell you. Can you imagine travelling overseas, most of them haven't been on a plane before, being told what to do, the pressure of representing your country, the pressure of playing in a tournament, the tiredness, the exhaustion, all those sort of things. They weren't used to people caring for them. They weren't necessarily people, following rules, because life had been pretty tough for them and they'd had to fend for themselves. But all of a sudden, they're working within a team framework, a family, a group. But we got there, and we had this amazing time. And when they returned, the players had a new sense of belonging, a new sense of purpose, an outlook on life. Some of them wanted to work. Some of them wanted to study. They wanted to maintain their rehab. They had represented their country. They could do anything else they wanted to. Why couldn't they? So we got back to Melbourne in a very dishevelled state, but pretty proud of what our achievement, sending our first team to the Homeless World Cup. But we didn't want to leave it there, to be honest. And in fact, the response we got from the wider community was amazing. So many groups were coming to us and saying, can we have a street soccer program in our own community? One in Sydney. So rehabs in Sydney and Adelaide would call us and said, we loved it, we saw what you did. I think it would work well in our city or in our community, which was just fantastic. But for us, we couldn't look past the first one. But wouldn't it be great, just like the Big Issue is a national organisation, that we could run street soccer all around the country and help more than just the group in Fitzroy? So what happened at that time, we also received another invitation, and this one that went to all the countries was for Melbourne or our organisation to stage a future Homeless World Cup. It was interesting. We sort of thought about it and, geez, Melbourne would be a good venue. We're so community-oriented. We love sport. Wouldn't a Homeless World Cup look good in Melbourne? Wouldn't the community get right behind it? And at the same time, instead of all those corporate doors and government doors being shut in our face, people wanted to know us. So my manager and I put our heads together and thought, how about we put in a bid for this event, and in that process, perhaps we get enough support to maybe expand our program to regional areas or maybe a couple of capital cities and see how we go. So we began this process of bidding for a Homeless World Cup. It's a little bit different to the Grand Prix and bidding for those major events, but you know something? An organisation called Melbourne Victorian Major Events, through a network of ours, was actually helping us do that. Now, they didn't have to. It wasn't going to earn the state millions of dollars, but we found more people that wanted to help. And their CEO started to just hold our hands as we wrote this compelling argument to bring this event here. All of a sudden, we're speaking to some of the big corporates. State government was talking to us. People wanted to offer a venue for the event. People wanted to offer food for the event. People wanted to volunteer for the event. So we put this compelling argument to bring the Homeless World Cup of 2008 to Melbourne. And shock horror, we get it. And then have to think, how are we going to put this thing on? So 2008, this amazing event that we've only been to once, is going to come into our backyard and we're going to put it on. A fledgling organisation like the Big Issue. But you've got to dare to dream and to think big. The Homeless World Cup is an annual event. So after 2005 Homeless World Cup in Edinburgh, the program continues. We then coordinate a team to go to Cape Town, South Africa. Here we go again. Another batch of eight players, another amazing journey, this time to a different country, a different cultural environment. But again, opportunity for eight more players to experience the chance of a lifetime. Now, I mentioned earlier that we won a few games in Edinburgh. We actually came seventh, which is a fantastic achievement in terms of participation and in terms of the score. But when we went to Cape Town, the team was probably not as skilled when it came to football. And in fact, we were really struggling to win a game. Really struggling, which was quite funny because we had this tradition that after we won a game or lost a game, drew a game, we'd sing our own rendition of Waltzing Matilda, and many of the coaches had come up to me and say, geez, your team hasn't lost a game, you must be so proud of them. I said, we haven't won a game. But we used to try and, you know, really capture the spirit of what it was about. But I recall that one day we'd played in Cape Town and we played Germany and we lost like 22 goals to nil, which is a 14-minute match. So if you do the math, that the goalkeeper's picking the ball out of the net pretty quickly. So the heads were bowed, the guys are feeling pretty down. And I decided we need to do something a bit more meaningful. And so we took the group by bus to one of the poor townships of Cape Town, a place called Lunga and a place called Khayelitsha, where we saw poverty and destitution in a pretty harsh form. And our guys, by their own admission, received their own dose of perspective. So guys who were working who were living in homeless shelters, guys who were receiving the dole or their unemployment benefit, saying, my God, I've got it good compared to these people. Yet the people that we saw were showing such determination. They had smiles on their face, and we took them soccer balls and we shared the afternoon together. And how is a loss to Germany, 22-1, ever going to compare to this? So it was a magnificent event again, Cape Town. We got to meet Archbishop Desmond Tutu, which was a fantastic experience for all of us, but particularly for one of our players. And he said to us, Australia's a fantastic nation. I love it. They're great at sport, but you must do more for your Indigenous people, which I thought was interesting. In 2007, the program continues. We start preparations for the Homeless World Cup of 2008 in Melbourne. In 2007, we go to Copenhagen, Denmark. Another batch of 8 players, this time to beautiful, beautiful Copenhagen. Now, this was a brilliant experience for me because I've been communicating with a friend of mine who's now started a team in Greece. Street soccer in Athens. You wouldn't read about it. So we get to Copenhagen and I see the blue and white Greek flag and my mate Chris, and we hug and embrace as one. You know what the magic thing is? We played against each other. And he and I sat in the same coach's bench and just enjoyed the game. And then when they beat us, we did the Zorba together as a group, and the whole crowd was loving it, which was what the true spirit of the event and of the competition was about. Now, I must admit, not all the teams do this. Some of the teams are more about winning and bringing home that golden prize, which to me sort of defeats the purpose. But we stick to our convictions, and that's why we've come 43rd the last few years and people are calling for my head as a coach. But Denmark wasn't all that much fun either, to be honest, because we had a pretty big challenge in that particular journey. One of our players, our captain, got injured on the first day. He did his knee on the first day. And he was taking a range of medication for his psychiatric illness, took some painkillers that upset the balance of his medication. He lost it, and we lost him, in the sense that he just left the village, ran away, and for 4 days was missing. Now, you might imagine, when you're doing this project, this is the biggest exercise in risk management you can imagine. You worry about a player falling ill, you worry about a player being unwell, you worry about a player committing a crime, you worry about everything. And a player is missing, and we are absolutely petrified and concerned and worried through our teeth. Fortunately, with a day or so before the event is completed, he turns himself into police and he ends up in a psychiatric institution. And with their support, and we're very lucky that the Danish medical services are really good, they rehabilitate him pretty quickly for him to be able to come back to Australia. But he's pissed off with me. Can I say that here? He's not happy with me. He feels I let him down. He's upset. He's ashamed. And he says, I want to go home alone. He doesn't want to come back with me. The team's left with my support staff. I've just got to make sure that he's safe and put him on a flight. One of the hardest things you could ever imagine for me to do. But it has to be done. Now, the good thing is that he and I have now talked it through, and he understands what's taken place. And there are risks associated with what we do. But the great thing is that he still uses that experience and learning to be able to overcome other aspects of his life and to call for help when he needs it, which is such a critical aspect to what we do, is that we all got to help each other and be honest with each other. So 2007, a fantastic event, which brings us to 2008, and I'm hoping some of you, many of you, might have come to this special event, which took place in Federation Square. So we put a street soccer pitch in the middle of Federation Square, which probably doesn't really make sense because it's undulating and got all sorts of bits and pieces to it, but we put a street soccer pitch there for a reason, because we wanted as many people as possible to come and see the event, learn from the event, and see what homeless people can do when they're given an opportunity. Come and see what they do when they're given a fair go, a good Aussie fair go. Melbourne University was the venue that housed all our participants. We had more than 1,000 volunteers from the wider community, from doctors to physios to retirees to people helping with marshalling to people helping all aspects of the event. We had corporate groups from Macquarie Bank, BHP, Goldman Sachs, JB Weir contribute to the event. We had people like Cadbury and Mars and whatever give food. And all of a sudden, what an amazing event. But why was it such an amazing event? Because everybody came together to try and solve a problem. We had the community sector in us and other groups who got behind it. We had government supporting, state and federal governments, and we had corporates involved. So all three sectors came together to try and make this event something special and try to solve a problem, which to me was something unique. You don't often see that, but shows you what can be achieved when the whole community get behind something big. And that was a magnificent event. I hope many of you had seen it. It was spectacular. Thousands of people, they estimate 100,000 people went past Federation Square during that week. 56 countries, street soccer programs have now grown all around the world, and there's 56 nations. And it's not just men, it's women as well. And we had a women's tournament of 8 countries playing that to demonstrate that women experience homelessness as well. A pretty unique event, pretty special event. But remember I mentioned earlier that one of our ambitions was to be able to run our street soccer program that was being run in Fitzroy, to expand that across the country. And our vision was to use the Homeless World Cup and the friends we'd made and the support we'd made to run it across the country, to make those friends in government, in the corporate sector. And we did that. The program now runs in 25 locations, and almost it will be 30 in a year's or so time, all around the country. So capital cities, regional areas, and Indigenous communities. So from something small has grown something big. And we used the Homeless World Cup of Melbourne in 2008 to expand across the country, which to my mind was something special and a project that I've been privileged to be involved. In 2009, we went to Milan, Italy, another batch of 8 players. An interesting event to say the least. See, in Melbourne, the whole community got behind it and it made it a success. You could feel the care, the warmth that the community showed, the interest that they showed, the support that they showed the homeless people. I'll be honest, and it's not casting dispersions on the people of Italy, but that was one of the worst events we'd been to. No crowd, little support. They put us up in army barracks. The community hadn't got behind it. And yet, such amazing event, significant event, international event, didn't really succeed. Did that demonstrate something about the way people viewed homeless people? Up for debate. But over the years, quite a bit of learning on my behalf. I've lost a bit of hair in the process, as you can see, but you probably can't see from that angle. But an amazing journey, as I mentioned, and something that I've really enjoyed. And so many things that I've learned about myself and about people and people facing different challenges. And I like to talk to students quite often about some of the things that I've learned. And I often talk about what we say is the 3 S's that people often need. And I call them sense of purpose, sense of belonging, and social support. And this is what we try and offer our players. A sense of purpose is something that we need when we wake up every morning. Something that drives us, a passion. Something that gets us out of bed, something that we look forward to, something that gives us a routine, something that we know is there for us to do, to see, to be involved in. We all need a sense of purpose in life. We also need a sense of belonging. For many of our players, they're feeling isolated. They feel discriminated. They feel like they're nobody. So they want to feel belong. They want to belong to the wider community. And we do that through the street soccer program, through their teammates. But you know what? It's even bigger than that. They want to feel part of the community. One of the things that I do is try and bring as many people down to our training as possible. If homeless people are feeling isolated, why do you just then have homeless people playing sport amongst each other? So I always bring corporates, schools, or anybody who wants to come down, participate with the players, and to learn from each other so we can build that sense of belonging and community belonging with our players. And thirdly, that of support and social support. Everybody needs a hand up. Everybody needs somebody to support them because life's not always rosy. And you need different types of support. Most of us are very fortunate that we've got familial support, but not all our players have that. So they might need a wider support network to be able to pick them up when they're down. We might need professional support. For me, important to have a mentor, a role model, somebody to look up to, somebody to bounce off ideas off, maybe somebody who gives you a bit of tough love. So we need that type of social support as well. So over the years, I've met some amazing characters, some truly amazing characters, some truly amazing personalities. And I've seen the program change lives. Being in the program now since 2005, it's been a great period of time to watch through almost a longitudinal study how people have changed. One of the players that I've worked closely with is a guy called Steve, who's a former international jockey, pint-sized jockey from the UK. And he travelled all around the world riding for the big trainers, riding for, you know, the sheiks and riding for all the big owners. And during that time, he had troubles with drugs and alcohol. Came to Australia with his wife, and things got pretty messy. Things got very messy. He ends up homeless. He ends up with naught to his bank account, and he loses his treasured son, or access to his treasured son. So what can we do for Stevie, or what can he do for himself? Because really it's about empowering the individual to be able to overcome these difficulties. How can we give him a sense of purpose? How can we give him a sense of belonging? How can we offer him support? He joins the street soccer program. He joins Alcoholics Anonymous. He gets support through housing, and he turns his life around. He's at training week in, week out. He keeps dry. I must admit, the first time he didn't succeed with his rehab. But he persisted. He was determined. He represents Australia in the Homeless World Cup of 2008. A year later, or 2 years later, he's studying to be a drug and alcohol counsellor. Last week I saw him at training. And you know what he's doing? He's bringing players from the drug and alcohol agency to training. A remarkable turnaround for him. An inspirational turnaround. There's Timmy. Timmy's a young Vietnamese boy that I worked with. Family violence at home. Timmy was involved with drugs and was selling drugs. He got caught by police with a significant amount on him. But instead of charging him with trafficking, he gets done for possession. The biggest wake-up call of his life. He's living in a men's crisis centre, crisis service, Ozenham House. Comes to training. He's the laziest player I've ever seen. It'd take 10 minutes to put his boots on, put the shin pads on, all that sort of thing. We work towards that, trying to build that up. I select him for the Homeless World Cup team of South Africa, Cape Town 2007. He's struggling big time. He's used to sleeping 12 hours a day. He's the only player, even though we didn't win a game, that didn't score a goal. He was too tired, too wrecked. He wanted to, but he just wasn't motivated enough. When we get back, Timmy's a new man. Timmy wants to study. Timmy wants to work. I said, one step at a time. He was just too excitable. He was working night shift at Toyota and trying to do a community service degree. He gave the study away, but for him to be doing night shift was such an amazing turnaround in character. I could not believe it. I saw him the other day, and he drives a Toyota worth triple my car's value, but how amazing to see that. And he tells me he wants to put down a loan to buy a house. So when I see that 5 years down the track and see these individuals turn around, to me it's all been worth it. But whether it's players who've turned their life around totally like that, I'm not going to sit here and say everybody can turn it around like that. In some cases, just to keep players out of trouble for those 2 hours, I'm happy for that. But we chip away, we chip away, we chip away. And so at training these days, it's a little bit more sophisticated and we've worked on the product. Players get a range of information about health and well-being. They get peer support, so we share information amongst the group. Our coaches mentor them and give them advice and information. We run a range of events, activities. We go on camps together. And so we're helping now 1,000 people all around the country through the street soccer program that started in 2005. A new innovation is that we're now running the program in some correctional facilities in prison. So I'm coaching a group of guys who have intellectual disabilities and find themselves in prison. Many have committed a range of different violent crimes, but I've seen themselves, and remember, I've worked in the victims of crime area, themselves, some of them have been abused over a long period of time. But the purpose of the program is the same, to rehabilitate them and to reconnect them with the program when they're released from prison. They've done their time. Hopefully we can support them and reintegrate them back into the community. So that's a new innovation to the program. So I look back on the work that I've done, and it's been a great 15 or so years. And I think to myself, what else could I be doing? My mum always wanted to, I think, me to be a lawyer or to be a doctor or, you know, to do something else. And it took me years to try and explain to mum what I did. But to me, the satisfaction is in seeing Timmy, is in seeing Stevie, and to see people. You know, last week I was in Townsville, to see people in Townsville get the benefits of the program. And there's no truer word is spoken when people say that it is in giving that we receive. The sacrifices I've made, I'll be honest, have been enormous. But to me, I've got so much out of the program that I've given. And if I'm going to finish shortly, but probably one of the greatest things that I've ever got from the Homeless World Cup is that I met my fiancée at the Homeless World Cup of Melbourne where she was volunteering. And on October 16, she and I will be married in this very church, won't we, Helen? I just embarrassed her. So I love sharing this story with different groups, corporate groups, students. And I hope they get a sense of where I'm coming from as an individual, some of the things that I've learned. And probably the truest thing that I often say to them is, we all need that sense and dose of perspective. As they say, there's always somebody worse off than you, but it's in giving that you receive. And if we can all as individuals chip in and give that little bit more, we can solve so many more problems in the world. Regrettably, I think there's too many people, we leave it to too few in the world. We leave it to too few. It's not always the fault of the individual. There's a lot of people out there that want to give, that want to help, that want to contribute in some way. We need to connect with those individuals and all do our bit and be able to face some of the difficulties in life. So if I can motivate individuals, or if I can connect people with ways that they can help, then I feel even more satisfied. So I'm going to leave it at that, and I'm sure there may be a few questions or comments. But as you can see, I'm pretty passionate about what I have been involved in over the last 15 years. I've been privileged to be able to represent my country, meet some of the most amazing people you can imagine. And you can have your sporting heroes and your idols and that, but the people that I work with every day are the people that inspire me and motivate me. And I hope that you get a sense of that too and get a sense of perspective that I have as well. Thank you.
Thank you for your talk. A question I would like to ask you is, through your interactions with all these homeless people over the years, has the concept or notion of God ever been raised? And if yes, if any of these homeless people have ever raised that notion of God, how have you approached it? Obviously with caution, do you totally ignore it? Mm-hmm. Do you give some response? Do you leave it up to them? But I would think that as these people, as they're turning their lives around, mm-hmm. I'm sure that the concept of God or the divine would have arisen in that discussion. I'd just like to find out, how do you approach that?
That's a great question. Look, I've got to be mindful that I work with different people, different groups, different religious backgrounds. And I don't want to force religion or any of, I guess, my values or judgment on an individual. But at the same time, I think most of the players know what I stand for. I guess I'm somewhat of a leader, somewhat of a role model. And many of them know of my Greek Orthodox background. They know of my values, what I stand for. And I guess that sort of flows through what we work with. And while we don't force the religious side of it, one of the key principles of our program is about ethical conduct. It's about how we treat people with respect and dignity, how we respect individual difference, how we learn from each other. And this is the same question that I was asked actually at a school leadership project program that I did last week. And many of our players actually do have enormous faith, and yet they might have been kicked in the teeth, experiencing some of the toughest challenges in life, yet they reach out for God, and God is with them, and they battle and toil hard. And you'd be surprised at the number of people that we work with. And sometimes it comes to a head around Easter and Christmas, like it does for all of us when we start and appreciate the religious significance, the familial significance. And that's when sometimes I observe some of the greatest pain for the individuals. But I can honestly say that many of our players do have faith in God, continue to go to church. In fact, where we are at the big issue, we're located next to Wesley Church on Lonsdale Street. Don't know if any of you know it. And some of our players will go and, you know, say a prayer. One of the players that I've worked with, young Manny, is a boy from Sierra Leone. People would know the story of Sierra Leone and lost his father very early. He's seen some of the most horrific things you can ever imagine. He was a war soldier, he himself admits to some of the atrocities he was forced to do. And we were doing a talk at Nike the other week, where Nike's a sponsor of ours, and he wanted to talk to them about his own personal issues. And he described the enormous faith and gratitude that he had for God for getting him through those tough times. And it was amazing the response he got from people. So it's not a matter of forcing, or the religious side of it probably is not strongly emphasized, but some real strong personal religious values come out, I guess, through that program.
I'll ask a question, George. Thanks again for your time and your talk. Father Chris mentioned briefly before you came on, what are some of the practical things that people like ourselves can do to get yep. involved in programs like the World Cup or yep. any other projects that are doing good things for the marginalised in Melbourne, yep. Australia?
Well, I think the first thing you can do, if I can get a plug in, is for people to buy a big issue. $5. Go buy a big issue from a vendor. Something unique, something special, to go up and chat to a vendor. As I mentioned earlier, imagine the difficulty and the fear that some of these people might have to sit on the streets and sell the magazine. And for you to go and buy that magazine is not only going to give them a couple of bucks in their pockets to go and get some food or to, you know, pay a bill off or anything like that, it gives them self-esteem and self-confidence and self-worth, as Father said. So if you can at least buy a big issue magazine, that'd be great, but you don't have to. Say good day. Which, for those people who feel so isolated, so downtrodden, so low, they feel alienated. They feel people are looking at them. And indeed, many of us are looking at them in that way. Smile at them. Have an understanding of what they might be going through. Have an understanding of some of the pain they're enduring. And in some ways, as I've said, look at them and be proud of them and celebrate what they're doing out there. But at the same time, many of us have probably got resources, human and other, to be able to help different organisations or different groups. As I mentioned earlier, if we all make that small contribution, we might be able to make things a lot easier, not leave it to those few. And it's not money, it's not always about money. And throughout the years, I haven't just asked organisations and companies for money. There's practical support. We've had IT support. We've had a range of different types of support you can offer the organisation or even the individual. Some individuals have offered some of our players work. There's so many different things that you can do, but I guess it needs a connection, it needs an understanding, but a willingness. And I think the willingness is almost there. There's a lot of people that want to reach out and help out, but we've got to do a lot more as a community to help people get over the line.
Thank you, George. That was a truly inspirational presentation. It reminded me of a story I heard a few years ago. Someone once shared with me, a grandparent and a grandchild were walking along the beach and there were thousands of stranded starfish. And the grandchild picked one up and threw it in the water. And the grandparent said, well, what's the point? It's only one. The grandchild said, well, it made a big difference to that single starfish. And thank you, you reminded me of that. Sometimes if we all just made one small difference, it all adds up.
Definitely.
Thank you, George.
George, the question I have for you is one drawn probably from your own personal experience that I'm going to ask you. But there are those in here that have also sort of followed your particular path. And observing carefully the streets of Melbourne, a lot of people seem to be hesitant in speaking to homeless people because there is a view that they are dangerous or they're drug addicts, they might stab you with a syringe. How does one approach this particular concern and how can one overcome it?
Yeah, that's a great question. I guess there's a perception that homeless people are dangerous and that we have a fear that they might attack us. They might come at us. But you know something? There are more crimes committed against homeless people than what homeless people commit against. And so a smile is a great thing. A smile comes from deep in here and goes a long way. And sometimes I guess people got to come out of their comfort zone a bit. It might be a bit difficult to do it. Crack that smile. It's pretty hard on a Monday or Tuesday morning when you're going to the office at 101 Collins Street and you're thinking, I've got 12 meetings today and I've got deadlines, and you've got your head down like that and you see a vendor or a homeless person and you're just worried about your own stuff. A smile goes a long way. So whether there's, you know, for you just to have that conscious consideration of somebody else or somebody else's story of what somebody might be facing, and it's not pity, it's just if you saw a family member or a cousin or anybody there, would you smile? I bet you would. And I think it just comes back to something that I talk about, and that's personal social responsibility. I often go and talk to corporates, and the big buzzword and big buzz terms is corporate social responsibility, but I talk about personal social responsibility, where us as individuals take an interest, make an effort to make our community and our society a better place. What can I do to make it a better place? There's no point us blaming society for the ills of young people, etc., etc. We all need to chip in. And if we all develop this personal social responsibility and make it a human movement, maybe it's part of our training as individuals, as adults, that we have a sense of personal social responsibility where we look after people who are worse off than us. That's just a principle and value that we live by. And then start to act on it. Goes a long way.
George, just wanted to thank you for that response because it is very difficult. Our church in particular has been struggling to create that sense of community, that sense of kinonia, that in today's day and age is very difficult to cultivate, since now the mass media, our economy is building this idea of we're all just a collection of individuals that are not linked to each other. And it is, I don't know, I think you would probably be the best person to speak on how this matter can be changed.
Well, I guess we live in a society where we're driven by all sorts of things and we lose sight sometimes of some of the pain and some of the difficult things in life because we're driven by sometimes greed or by society's sort of, how should I put it? We have this emphasis on getting more, doing more. There's competition, there's this, there's that, but you know, you've seen what's happened recently this year with floods, with tsunamis, with cyclones. But when we see it, we reach out and we feel the pain. But the thing is, there's a lot of pain that happens that we can't see. How do we get that perspective? Do we wake up in the morning and say, have a think of those people who are worse off than us? But also for us to think more globally as a community, for our neighbour. It comes back to looking after ourselves, our neighbours, our family. You know, we often talk about, you know, young people getting into strife and young people of today getting, you know, drugs, and they don't study, they're on the computer all day and that sort of stuff. But we as a community have to take some responsibility. We have to build the environment. We have to take responsibility for that too. But we're probably too focused on our own self rather than the wider community. Now, some people might think that's how they want to live. I guess I see things a little bit differently. And that's why my mind probably ticks over at night thinking how I can solve all the world problems and I never get to sleep. But but I think if we all did that, it'd make a difference.
Great work. I just want to ask, how do you maintain it? How do you, so it doesn't just roll off the track? You know, like, it's getting quite big. What type of measures have you put in place so it doesn't fall off?
In terms of the program?
The program, yeah.
Yep. Well, I think it's about, we expanded so far, it's about consolidating, it's about evaluating the program, asking the participants what they get out of it, what do they value the most about it. My role now is to mentor all the coaches around the country, and so I do that in different ways by going to visit them. I contact them regularly by phone. We have phone conferences. I set up all sorts of resource directories to train them up because they're not all psychologists. Sometimes they're just regular Joe Blows out there who just have a passion for working with people, want to help people. They're great role models. And so we try and, I guess, develop the program further. And we've got to probably almost 30 programs. And it's not about just expansion and thinking that's great. It's about making sure it's the best possible product for the individual and they get a lot out of it. And our players give us the feedback that that's what they get out of it. And you know, these days you have to justify in many ways the value of the money that you're given by government or by corporate organisations. And we have a relationship with La Trobe University and they do an assessment and interview our players and we get some fantastic feedback. So you've got to make sure that we're on the right track.
How do you allow the players to know what you do professionally without it scaring them off, so to speak?
How do I allow the players to know?
Like, as in, because you're saying they come down and play soccer or football or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and they see you as just a football
just George.
Coach.
Yeah. Look, I think most of them.
You've also got your professional stuff behind you.
Yeah, my
you.
Professional background and my psychology training.
How do you kind of integrate the two without, like, so you've got your boundaries of, they're not a friend, they're a client or whatever, but then not doing that in a way that's going to scare them off.
No, I know what you're saying. And for those of us who work in helping professions or working with young people or working in different client settings, we understand there's significant professional boundaries, personal boundaries that you cannot cross and to have that understanding. But whether I've had my psychology training or not, and it does help me and give me some great skills and understanding of what the players are going through. Probably the one thing that I do is treat these people with respect and treat them with dignity and I don't judge them. They're the main things. And whether I've got psych training or not, if people can do that, you'll find that you can connect with people so much better. But they have to know, most of the players understand that I am a worker. In some ways I am a friend, but also I don't cross those boundaries because That can often be dangerous in that respect too. But I act as their role model and mentor. And, you know, that can be difficult for me and there's pressure on me. But, you know, anecdotally, the players say, we learn from the way you conduct yourself, the way you handle pressure. You don't lose your temper. You listen carefully to all the players. And some of them haven't had that. They might have had difficult familial and parental relationships. And so it's never too late to learn. And so I try and just demonstrate a good character and some good behaviour, and culture rubs off on people. But it's not just me, it's their peers. They learn from their peers as well. And the peers who are showing the best character and attributes, we highlight as leaders. And that filtrates through the players as well. So the culture of the program is about development, it's about people improving their lives
and about achieving and growing.
Thanks, George, for your talk. My question is, you seem very dedicated, very committed. You obviously put so much of yourself into your work. How do you cope with the letdowns and disappointments and people that go back to that old, the old ways, personally and on a professional level as well?
Yeah, good question. And I feel the pain and the frustration. And over the years, sometimes I've doubted myself or I've doubted the program if players had, you know, regressed or gone back to drugs or alcohol. But I guess you have to be rational and understand, and we are as professionals, the people that we're working will fall in and out sometimes of cycles. Unfortunately, that's the case. But somehow there's that drive, and, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the success stories, whether it's one or two or 10 or 20, they keep driving you further and you work that little bit harder and you never give in. And you have faith in people because you know they can turn it around. But I work with some prisoners with intellectual disabilities, and to be honest, most of them are going to, you know, spend most of their lives in prison. Their IQ is less than 70. Some of them last a couple of days when they're released out of prison. And most people would probably give up on them. You can't do that. You cannot do that. And if you can help one, you'll be out there trying. So it does take a bit of determination, and sometimes you hit a flat spot or it hurts, and sometimes you take it personally. But you've just got to regroup and overcome those self-doubts or program doubts. And that's what's happened over 5-6 year term. When I see some players have up, down, but I've seen the players who have gone straight up as well.
Well done on your presentation, thank you. I spend a bit of time once a week, a few hours of a week at St. Mary's House of Welcome, which is probably around the corner from...
from where we... yeah, fantastic place.
And you see the same faces again and again. And from what you speak to staff, and they say, oh, they've been coming for forever, it seems. And it might seem a naive question, but will there ever be an end to homelessness?
Can I be honest?
Yeah.
No. You can give everyone in the world a roof over their head, and regrettably there'll always be homelessness, because you've got to look at what causes homelessness, and that's mental illness, abuse, violence, mental illness, all those things. Can we stop those? It's going to be pretty difficult to do that. So you can give a roof over their head, but a roof over their head is not the only thing they need. They need to be part of society. They need a sense of purpose. They need to study. They need to work. They need to feel part of the community. Sometimes they fall back into that vicious cycle. And, you know, for some of our players, they reach there, they've got a roof over their head, and sometimes they think they're not worthy, and they can subconsciously almost sabotage it. So, again, homelessness is such a complex issue. And sometimes I see when, you know, an individual is given a roof over their head and then they forget, or they're not given the other supports, and I worry because I don't think that that's the right level of support. They need more than just that roof over their head. So they need to maintain their support. They need to find a passion. They need to find a social group. They need a community to belong to. And it makes it hard.
We've all heard the saying that you give a man a fish and you feed him for a day, and you teach him how to fish, and you feed them for life. And yep. The big issue is obviously a real example of teaching somebody to fish, whereby you're helping the vendors help themselves.
Yes.
What I'm leading to is, what are your thoughts on people on the streets that approach you and ask you for money? Yep. And the most common answer that most of us and all of us have probably given at some point is, I'm not giving that person money because he's a junkie, or he's going to spend it on alcohol or drugs or whatever. What are your thoughts on that?
Yep, that's a great question. Our organisation, by the way, our motto is a hand up, not a hand out. Now, that's confronting in the sense that when somebody asks you for money and you see in them, you know, the pain and the, you know, the hunger, it can be really, really confronting. To be honest, I don't give money to individuals. And what I'd like to do, and this is a project that I've thought about over the years, is one that they have implemented in some Scandinavian states and even in the UK, where if you give a particular gold coin or coin to an individual in a homelessness situation, they are able to get food and coffee with it. I think if people had that understanding, that that money would go towards that person's feeding, then that would make a difference. It is difficult, and people are confronted by it and begging, but whether that solves a problem or not, we're about empowering people to change their life. It makes it hard. There are a lot of organisations out there that help by way of food, material aid. It's not as easy as that, of course, and it's harsh and probably some tough love. But for me, that's why I have enormous respect for the big issue vendors, because they're not begging. They're out there working. They're legitimate workers. To me, they're working harder than those corporate dudes up at Collins Street. But that's not to say that I don't have any pain, and I don't feel pain, or I don't feel any empathy for the individual who does ask for money. But it does place us as a wider community in a difficult situation. And that's why I'd love a system in which if we could hand something out that meant they could get food, we'd all feel a bit more comfortable. But at the same time, that's not to say that our big issue vendors, when they've bought the magazines or sold the magazines, don't use it on drugs or gambling. Who are we to say? And we don't judge them. We'd rather they wouldn't. And we try and help them because they're in our family, in our community, and we'll try and work with them.
I went across the road from my uni. I'm at ACU on Victoria Parade, and I went across the road one day when I had some time to light a candle at church because I thought, oh, the church is open, I'll go and light a candle.
Mm-hmm.
And this youngish Greek, young-looking Greek man was there, homeless person, he was saying, they're all left out.
Yep.
I was very impressed with how the old man who was looking after the church handled the situation. He didn't turn the man away,
yep.
But he said, hang on a minute. He went and got some phosphora and dithero and gave the man some church bread and said, you know, take this home and eat it in the morning.
Yeah.
Or have a bit now if you're hungry or whatever. And the man did say, oh, no, I want money. I want to get a burger. Said, I don't give money. And I just thought,
well, good have on a think him. About this week. Most of us, a weekend, we would have eaten out or had parties. I had my 40th birthday yesterday, and we had copious amounts of food left over. We tried to share it amongst ourselves. But think about the wastage that happens in our community on a daily basis. Now, that frustrates me. And as I said, when I first started working in housing and homelessness, and I saw people who were hungry and hadn't eaten or in different situations, I'd go home and have an 8-course Greek meal for my mum. It's pretty tough for me, and I just always think there's so much out there that we waste that we could share amongst ourselves for people who haven't got food. So again, I'm appreciative whenever I have a good meal and would love. And there's some great organisations out there that actually collect food from markets and different restaurants and things like that. Oz Harvest, Second Bite, has anybody heard of those? Well, they share food with material aid organisations and also Big Issue. They bring fruit and food to our training for our players. So there are great organisations that do things like that. Well, to be honest, most of our players and people that I've worked with don't have a lot of money. And they just survive without, which is difficult because many of them don't know how to plan financially, what the value of the money is. And then housing's difficult, and then paying their bills is difficult. So I have to do a lot of work in trying to mentor the players about all those life skills and how to cope and live independently like individuals. And I've seen players that we've gone overseas with who will give money or give their belongings away to people who are worse off than themselves. So they themselves are amazing like that. They don't accept sometimes. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. Sometimes if they haven't asked, obviously they might find that a little bit, you know, looked down upon. But I've seen players share their food, share their money, share their smokes, share everything they've got with their mates and peers who are also homeless, which I admire greatly too.
George, if I can perhaps just ask a question before we conclude. People you've been speaking about tonight, they're sounding like they're mostly adults that you've been dealing with. I'm just wondering what the situation in Melbourne for children who are homeless, because in Sydney, where I'm originally from, they had a huge problem, and I think they may still be having a problem with a lot of children who are homeless. Could you say something about Melbourne at least?
Regrettably, we have a significant population of youth homelessness as well, probably 16 to 25. Most of the situations revolve around family violence, family situations. And for us to work with those young people is really challenging before some of them, you know, get on the wrong side of the law or off the tracks, that sort of thing. Sport is a great way to do that. But it's amazing, not all of them are from backgrounds that you'd think, low socioeconomic status. We've had, you know, young people who are in, you know, good, wealthy families or high socioeconomic status, but things go wrong, find themselves on the street, and it's pretty easy to go downward spiral pretty quickly. So working with young people is just like any individual, really, but most of the people we work with are probably between 25 and 30, but we still have a significant group of young people, and there's some great organisations out there like Melbourne City Mission, and there's an organisation called Front Yard that provides housing and support to them. But we realise that sometimes you need to get in early before they get into that cycle of homelessness, cycle of drug abuse or alcoholism, because you can imagine, depending on the situation which renders you homeless, and sometimes it's family violence, a way of escaping is to take substances, to take drugs, and that also puts you in danger. So we want to nip that in the bud and really have an early interventionist approach.
You think there are good facilities and resources available in Melbourne for that problem?
There can always be more.
Oh, there always can be
and
more.
And there needs to be more. And it's funny, most people would recall that, when was it, Kevin Rudd was voted in at the second last election, that homelessness was high on the agenda, high on the priority, high in the media, and we've probably seen that drop off. But at the same time, I try and educate people, and particularly policymakers, to understand the complexity of homelessness and to understand the relationship between family violence, mental health, substance abuse, intellectual disability. So you need to see it within all those frameworks as well. So some of the policymakers are really good at understanding it, but it also comes down to sometimes the funding and the commitments the government want to make towards it. But we can't rely on governments all the time. We as a community need to make an effort and try and help in that area as well.
But on behalf of all of you, I'd just really like to thank George for coming this evening. I knew it'd be an inspirational talk after having spoken with George many times myself. And I really appreciate, George, because sometimes it can really feel overwhelming, the work you do, and sometimes for us as a community to try and help with something like this. But tonight I feel that you gave us something that makes us feel that, well, even on an individual level, if not on a community level as well, on a daily level, when we meet people in need, and after all, isn't what that our faith is all about? Just meeting the needs as we meet them on a day-to-day basis. So wherever we are, however we are, we can meet people's needs or help to support, just as we hope when we're down that there are people there for us as well. So thank you very much, George,
You're welcome.
For tonight.
My pleasure.
Through the prayers of our Holy Fathers, Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen. May God bless you all and keep you well, and see you soon.